Elise Guttenberg creates whole worlds in her writing. Now, the creation of worlds isn't unusual for a writer. Most writers do that. But not every writer creates the world of the book from the ground up. Elise's first book was Sunder, Eclipse, and Seed. Her latest novel is called Summer Light. It's an Alaskan prehistory. I'm Susan McInnes. This is Conversations. Elise, welcome, and thanks
Hi.
For joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure. This book is first of all, it's a big book. It's nearly 500 pages long. It takes us back in time and creates a culture for us. Because I want to spend as much time as we can during this hour on this book, I think I want to start with time. Prehistory ends at the point where history takes over, mm-hmm. but when we think about it, it really just goes back and back and back and back. Can you set the time of this book for us? When's it happening?
Before I started writing the book, I needed to think about that very seriously. I had to set it in a time and in a location so that I knew what and who I was going to be writing about. So that was one of the first questions that I had to deal with, when and where. I knew it was going to be in Alaskan prehistory, and I knew that I did not want to go back 10,000 years ago to the time when people were perhaps first crossing the Bering Land Bridge. Other writers had done that, and I didn't want to do the same thing that other people were writing about. I also didn't want to go that far back in time because I wanted to do something that I thought other writers weren't doing, and that was to lean very heavily on the ethnographies that were being written during early contact times, our historical times, when the first explorers were coming through. Mm-hmm. So to do that, I felt like I had to find a place that went back a little bit, but not too far. Mm-hmm. I started reading through the material on early Alaskan archaeology, and I also had set myself one other parameter that I knew, and that was that I wanted to write about cultures that predated the whalers that we think about as the traditional early Eskimo material. So I wanted to go back before that. And as I started reading, I found about 2,000 years ago, right around the year BC, two cultures that were roughly contemporaneous in northern Alaska. And those were the people that I chose to model the book on. Elik, my main character, belongs to a culture called Norton. And that's in the area of Norton Sound, the Nome Coast going around to St. Michael's and the area that today is Yupik Eskimo. Mm-hmm. Alanek, my hero, Elik's romantic figure, comes from further north. He's from approximately the Point Hope area. Mm-hmm. And he's modeled on a culture called Iputak. And the dates were around 200 BC, 300 BC, up to perhaps the AD range. So I narrowed it in there.
Okay. So what we know about this, not to be too primary school about it, but not to be too basic, but the animals are the same. The people are roughly contemporaneous with us, Homo sapiens sapien, and they live in cultures that predate and extend back from cultures we might find in the Norton Sound area today. Is that roughly right?
Yes. The archaeologists, at this point in time, it would be more difficult if they went back earlier, but have a pretty consistent flow of cultures. Churis before Norton, Norton leading into Iputak, Iputak leading into Burnick, Burnick into the pre-Thule. Right? There is definitely a flow chart that can be followed in the archaeology. Yes, but these are people that are recognizable to us. When the archaeologists show the lithic material that they dig up, the harpoon heads and the points. Lithic meaning stone.
Stone.
And that's what's left in the ground, you know. 2,000 years ago in this area, clothing doesn't survive. You know, we can't look at anything that was made out of animal hides or wood. It's very poor preservation area. The soil's wet. The coastline has changed slightly. And these people built their houses near to the coast so that they could go hunting in the sea and fishing. That's all faded. What's left is the lithic remains, the stone remains. And when the harpoon points and the antler, harpoon heads are shown to people living there today, they can recognize them. And they say, oh, I know what that is. That's a scraper tool. Oh, I can see that. That's a harpoon head. That's a, you know, this or that. Uh-huh. So, yeah, they're still people like us. Like, we're only talking about 2,000 years ago.
This question has to come in early. When you set out to write this book, you didn't set out to write this book. You went to your publisher and suggested another book, right? Mm-hmm. The question I have is, how did this book come about? And I suppose I just want to, yes, I just want to ask you that straight out, and then I have another question to follow that. Where did this book come from?
Well, the publishers gave me a lot of latitude. They did not frame this book in any way, but they asked very seriously that I write an Alaskan book. And it's kind of a funny story. I was going back to New York to meet with my editors to talk about my first book, Sunder, Eclipse, and Seed. And I like to tell this story because the setting is so far from New York. And mm-hmm. the time frame when I was writing that was right around when Salman Rushdie's whole incident with the Middle East had broken out. And I went to the building in New York, and there was tremendous security. And that's because my publishers and Salman Rushdie's American publishers were the same people. So you go up to these glass doors, and there's security, and you can't get in, you know, without having your editor come out and look at you and make sure you're the person who you told the receptionist that you were. Then you're invited in. So we did that, and I said hi, and we go down to lunch. And this is my editor taking me out to lunch kind of deal. And we go to a lovely restaurant down a few blocks in the middle of Manhattan. And we sit down, the waiter pulls out my chair. And I haven't even sat down and taken my napkin off and this is and put it in my lap, and the editors are saying, "Well, when are you going to write your Alaskan book?" And I was really floored. I was not ready for that question. And I said, "Oh, no, I'm not going to write an Alaskan book." This was 1989, I mm-hmm. believe, right when Sunder, Eclipse, and Seed had just come out. I said, "Oh, I take that very seriously, and it's not something I would enter into lightly." And I hadn't ever even thought about it. 2 years later, they asked the same thing. "Well, when are you going to write your Alaskan novel?" And I said, no, you don't understand. I have a background as an anthropologist here in Fairbanks. I see this as a responsibility that I would have to the material, to the people. These are other people's stories. I can't do this. Then finally, came around that another year went by, and I was throwing a few ideas, proposals out on the table, because I had finished two books for them, and I knew that I had to think ahead for another contract, for another novel. And I had several preliminary proposals worked out for other books that I wanted to do. But because I knew they were interested in the Alaskan material, I thought to myself, "Well, let's just see what they say." And I sent a letter with a very tiny paragraph saying, "Well, if you want to still talk about an Alaskan book, maybe I'll do something like a retelling of a myth, the Sedna myth I had in mind." And my agent took it to New York and called me back instantly and said, "They want the Alaskan material. They want it. Give us an outline. Forget what you're working on." You know. So I said, "Well, what do they want?" He said, "Well, don't do that, you know, retelling of a myth. Give us a prehistory. Give us a real story of what life might have been like in Alaska long ago." They said, "Everybody wants to read about Alaska." And so I sat down and I started thinking about it.
This is lucky and fortuitous on the one hand, but mm-hmm. frightening on another, isn't it? I mean, overwhelming in some ways.
I took it very seriously, especially mm-hmm. when I didn't yet know what was I going to write. Mm-hmm. What I did was I came here to the university library and started reading and immersing myself in the material and finding first a locale and in time, and setting myself several known parameters. And the decisions that I made at that early stage set up the entire book really quite rapidly. I decided that I wanted to write about a woman, and I wanted her to be a shaman, because it came to me as I started my reading that I needed somebody who stood in a position where she could look at her whole culture and give us her whole worldview, somebody who knew the spiritual as well as the everyday, somebody who wasn't necessarily always housebound. Right? On the other hand, I wanted to contrast her culture to give us a better idea of looking at the whole world. So I brought in Alanek from further north, from another culture, so I could have a conflict that would again expose and give me the way to enter into their world. Mm-hmm. You know, two people from different backgrounds will have much more to discuss than somebody representing it, who wouldn't necessarily think of all the same questions.
Alanac also comes as a stranger to a community that is distrustful of strangeness and strangers. Mm-hmm. So he comes into pretty sharp relief and throws the community he comes into pretty sharp relief because of his strangeness, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that sets up the conflict that good fiction needs. So that at the same time that I have my means to explore the material and the culture and the worldview, I have my story right there. And I can use the themes from the culture. He comes in, he's alone, he's adopted in by Elik's uncle, Grail. That shows one aspect of the fluidity of the kin group. You can be adopted in, you move and you live where it's necessary. At the same time, he's different, and he brings his differences, and they frighten people, and they worry people. So he has to fight for his own survival. Elik has her conflict, which pushes the fiction and the story for her. Mm-hmm. She wants to be a shaman. She wants to be taught. She wants to learn whatever she can. And so I set it up that way. And they want to get together in a romantic sense.
This is Elise Guttenberg, our guest today on Conversations. The book we're talking about is Summer Light. It is the first of two. Elise is now writing the sequel to that book. Summer Light is a HarperCollins book. It came out in 1995, and it is, as we've said, an Alaskan prehistory. Elise Guttenberg is a longtime Fairbanks resident. This is a question that is both odd and pertinent, I think, but I'd like to ask you about it despite its oddness and perhaps because of its pertinence. You're a white woman, roughly middle-aged, Jewish, from an urban background, who has adopted Fairbanks for her home, a demographic portrait. And you're writing about, in an era of identity politics, which you take seriously, you're writing about a different culture from a different time. Did you have moments where you stepped back and said, am I the person to be writing this, despite what HarperCollins asked you to do? Mm-hmm. And how did that impact the writing, I guess? Because I know you went ahead to do so.
Yeah. I can answer that on several levels. Before I agreed to do this, I had to finally come along to a point where they convinced me that they could get anybody to write an Alaskan book. Mm. And they had indeed had people write about, the New Mexico area or the Pueblo area, people who didn't necessarily live there. But they said to me how much better it is if they can get somebody to write a book who actually lives there. And I knew they were right. And I knew that there were other people in the state who were, likely going to come around and write books about Alaska, prehistories, fantasies, contemporary, whatever. And so there was a point where I said, okay, why not me? I have my undergraduate degree here in anthropology. I do care about this material. And the more I thought about it, the more I said, I would really love to investigate it further. On the other hand, when I was picking the time that I set this book in, I was very much afraid as a woman, and I'm a feminist, and I'm very, liberal inclinations. I didn't want to write a story about a culture that, before I began, I perceived might be very macho. And I had read other prehistories where there were a lot of rape scenes, and the women are very much delegated to the back corner of their society, and I worried about that. Mm-hmm. But the more I began reading, the more I realized that that was not at all going to be a problem. The richness of this culture and the differences in gender relationships were so vast from what my preconceived notions were that I absolutely enjoyed exploring them and mm-hmm. felt that it was important also for me to add to the conversation that's out there and say, look, the attitudes towards women in this book are something that need exploring again.
How did you discover those attitudes about women? Where'd they come from?
Reading. living downstairs in the library here. When I was investigating who Alanek was, his personality, his motivations seemed to come clearly to me through the archaeological record. There was he clearly represented one culture coming into conflict with another one, his styles of tool making, his belief in what was a burial cult and shamanism were very much stronger than the Norton people that Iluk represents. But to find her was quite a bit harder. The attitudes that I seemed to be finding stood back in the ethnographies of like the late 1800s when Edward Nelson was writing for the Smithsonian, let's say, that material. Those white male anthropologists coming in definitely took a further step back when they talked about women.
Oh,
there were big gaps, yeah. And I couldn't find very easily what I was looking for. There was information about how during women's menstrual periods they had to stay in a separate hut, you know, or in a separate room. And I said, okay, but what was that like? How did that feel for them? Did that make the women feel isolated, or did that make them feel like they were somehow lesser? And eventually, the more I read, the more I found out, no, that wasn't really the case at all. The women visited with each other constantly. They had a very strong, what we would call a support network. One word very early on kept coming across in the writings of Giddings, who did a small monograph on the Kobuk River people. And he kept mentioning this word kungyak, and he defined it as meaning poison. And he was saying that when a woman is in her menstrual cycle, she's poison to the spirits. They're frightened of her and they go away. The same word he used to mean illness. But a few pages later, he took that word about women and he used it to mean close to the spirits. Right? And I was saying, something is going on here, I said to myself. I can't follow all this. This is directly a conflict. And so I started looking for more anthropological material. And I didn't eventually find it. You know, one citation in a journal led to another citation in a journal. And it was in the much more recent material that the anthropologists are writing that I found my women.
Well, fascinating. Yeah. Did you sometimes feel lost in this research?
Oh, I loved this research. Yeah, reading and going through this quest, you know, this search is delightful, and the time flies away, and you have to pull yourself back and say, "Oh no, get to the story. We can't just search all these techniques and spend all our time learning how to make a basket."
Right. This is Elise Guttenberg with us on Conversations. I want you to read for us if you can, because, I should just say it. I really enjoyed this book a lot, and I think readers will enjoy it as a good read, as an opportunity to learn about a culture and a time that we don't live in, and an opportunity to look at evolving cultures over time. So with that advertisement, one of the themes that you've already brought up from the book is the balance of men's roles and women's roles. And you and I have talked separately on the phone about the importance of women's roles to the wholeness of the community. There's a passage where Iluk takes her proper place as Alanek's wife over the disposition of, I'm not sure whether it's a seal or that's been brought in. Maybe that's a good place to start our reading. This book is a HarperCollins book brought out in 1995. Elise Guttenberg is the author and also our guest today.
Mm-hmm. In this section, Alanek has been out hunting and he's brought back a seal, and the people have been hungry. And it shows a little bit of what I was talking about with the culture's attitude towards women as the owners of the meat. She listened to the talk, the women discussing the names of which house had the right to the meat, which woman was closest. Alana's sister, Little Pot, they said, had been married to Nua's brother, and so she had a right to help. except for her hands, Annie's wife said. Her wrists give too much pain to hold a knife. Two ravens could do the work. Two ravens busied herself with her baby, a lump nearly invisible beneath her parka. I have this little one to nurse. Perhaps Miko? She isn't related closely enough. Squirrel shifted her feet. Perhaps I might. Elix's glance shifted. Why to Squirrel, when she was the one who had spoken loudest against Alanek? She looked at two ravens, found no clues. To Ani's wife, who was already squinting toward the drying racks, figuring each seal that had come during the season, to which house and when. As was Squirrel. Ela could almost see the girl's thoughts turning, worrying less now about dogmen and more about the count of pelts stretched on drying boards outside the house. The fox pelts, and now the seals a certain man had caught when no other man brought any. And now, more clearly, Elik realized where the factions lay. Barehand whispered stories in the Kazgi with the men. His daughter Squirrel spread gossip with the women in their houses. As for her, she'd put her trust in her relatives, with Grey Owl and Nua. Quickly, before someone spoke louder, she stepped from the women's line. With Nua's painted bowl held out for all to see, she stepped along the hard-packed path to where the men had gathered around the seals. She knelt beside the larger seal, rolled it over so it would see upward to the sky. From inside her parka, where her skin kept it from freezing, she pulled out the small bladder Nua had filled with water. Carefully, she'd spill it if she thought about all the eyes watching her now. She undid the lashing that held the plug, poured a small amount into Nua's bowl, and held it to the seal's thin lips. For your thirst, she added, so you will remember the people who thought of you. Above her, Alana's voice answered for the seal. These people gave me water, and I will tell my family that these things are here for them as well. I will tell them where to swim. Elik tipped the bowl. A few drops spilled to the seal's mouth. Come again, she said. Forever, come again. She brought out the ulu Nua had given her, lowered her hood. A few paces back from the seal, the soles of a man's boots came into her line of sight. She glanced at the boots, but no higher. Black crimped soles against the white of the snow. The pattern of caribou leggings stitched to the soles of the bearded seal. Nua's work. Nua's son. Elik's knife hovered above the dark mound of the seal's belly and then dipped in. She felt the easing push of a well-sharpened knife. A good sign. The butchering wouldn't be painful for the seal. Upward she cut, through the skin, through the thick layer of fat and into the choicest parts first. The ribs, the liver, the heart. Her hands moved proudly, as only a woman, an owner of meat, knew how.
This passage gives us some sense of kind of the jostling for position that goes on in all cultures at all times. And at the same time, it also tells us something, and what I'd like you to do is to expand on this, of what the woman's role is in terms of the hunt, the relationship, or the importance the woman has to what the man is doing out on the hunt.
Mm-hmm. I brought in to share with you one of the articles that I keep referring to. This is from an anthropologist writing today, Barbara Bodenhorn, and she wrote this for a journal called Inuit Studies. And it's from pieces like this that I found out just how in the traditional whaling cultures, the importance of the women was crucial in the hunt. Mm-hmm. And here she argues that Inupiaq women, and most particularly wives, are considered pivotal to successful hunting. She says, when a man has killed an animal, its soul, its inua, must be treated correctly. Marine animals should be offered a drink of fresh water by a woman, for instance, and land animals should have their heads severed in order to allow the soul to escape. The hunter's wife butchers the animal and shares at least some of the meat. The animal's spirit recognizes her generosity, is pleased, and offers itself up to the hunter again. Mm-hmm. Just as the carcass is transformed into food, so customarily the hide might be transformed into a second skin for the hunter. The woman's needle, according to some, makes the hunter. And there's one more quote here. As among Inupiat, as among northern hunters in general, hunting is a sacred act. Animals give themselves up to men whose wives are generous and skillful. It is also the man's responsibility to treat the animals properly, but it is the woman to whom the animal comes. Shortly after my arrival in Barrow in 1980, preparations for fall whaling began. I mentioned something to a Point Hope man about only men hunting. He looked at me for a moment and said gently, "The whale comes to the whaling captain's wife." When asking Leona Akakuk about this, she remembered one very successful inland hunter who simply said, "I'm not the great hunter. My wife is."
Huh. No.
I really enjoyed exploring those themes of interdependence between the genders. Mm. Even though the work is very much separated, the men hunt the big game, the women stay home, take care of the food, the butchering, the skins, the children, the cooking. Yet both are necessary for success, and both recognize the need for each other's skill, because your skill in what you do it totally equals your survival. You know, a man needed to know how to sew up a hole in his boots if he was out on the ice,
yes,
or else he was going to die. But if it, you know, so I don't know that he worried so much about, "Oh, I can't do this, this is a woman's job," but he needed his wife and recognized, and I think respected her very much, because his survival depended on that. Mm-hmm.
If she sewed loose stitches, he would die. He could not hunt.
Right, in the practical sense, and in the spiritual sense also. If she was not generous, if she was not careful in the ritual duties, the animals literally would not come.
This is Elise Guttenberg with us today on this edition of Conversations. We're talking about an Alaskan prehistory. It's called Summer Light. It's a book of fiction as well as an interesting documentary of an earlier time. I'm Susan McGinnis, and with us today, Elise Guttenberg, on this edition of Conversations. Before we get too far away, someone will be wanting to write down the name and title of the author and title of the piece you just read from. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a quick look at that?
This was from Barbara Bodenham, and the title of the article is "I'm Not the Great Hunter, My Wife Is," in Inuit Studies, 1990 edition.
Okay. Inuit Studies, I-N-U-I-T, Studies, 1990 edition. This is Conversations. Where shall we go from here? I almost want you to read again for us, because of a sense I have of another theme in the book, and that's the, if we look at the importance of the relationship between men and women relative to ensuring survival on the planet, a second theme that you worked in was the sensitivity of humanity's impact on the Earth. Elik talks about the importance of now I think she uses the word laws, rituals and appropriate action. This in some ways takes us back to the menstrual hut. It takes us back to women's attitudes and activities while men are hunting. I'm interested in this notion of a culture's consciousness of its effect on the world. Does that make sense in asking? Okay, I'm not wandering too far afield. Good.
Yeah. I think the part that you're referring to is here in the beginning. And Elik has had a vision of a loon, and the loon has raised its hood and shown her its inner spirit. And as she's walking back to the village, she's thinking about what does it mean? What does everything in her worldview mean? She's also the kind of personality, because she wants to be a shaman, very curious, and she's always pushing at things. Mm-hmm. It goes, Elik tried to understand, but there was so much in the world that a person could hardly begin to comprehend. Inuktuk was dead. The part of his soul which brought life to his body had gone to the land of the dead. All customs, all rituals had been properly kept, and already a baby had been given his name. His breath soul had found its way to life again. So it was with people, so it was with the animals in the sea and on the land and with the birds who flew. Life is unending as the summer grass. The thought of it filled her with joy, and yet there were dangers everywhere. With everything a woman did, the way she walked while her father hunted, how loudly she spoke, the way she cut her meat. All must be done with care. Someday, when she became a wife and a family depended on her, she would show the animals how gentle she could be. She would never forget to offer a sip of fresh water to each newly killed seal, and they would see how generously she shared her food. The fish, the caribou, the seals, they would see her and come willingly to her husband's harpoon, to the traps she set. The laws were many. They were sometimes difficult. But how else could a person hope to have an effect on a world so beautiful and so dangerous both? Mm-hmm. One of the things that I needed to do when I was trying to discover what people might be like, people who lived 2,000 years ago, was I kept thinking of it in terms of where we are today.
Yes.
We all, I think, have in our human nature the need to understand the world around us. They saw that whatever actions they did had a direct bearing on the success of their hunt. If they were loud or if they forgot the proper rituals, the animals would not want to come to their family. We seem today to do many things also. We look for ways that we affect the world. People in different cultures will go to saints to intercede. Mm-hmm. we have prayers, we have our own beliefs. I keep seeing everywhere human nature wanting to understand. And so that was something I could hold on to in trying to discover the personality and the thoughts of someone living 2,000 years ago. They lived very close, immediately, to the world around them. And if there was sickness, they believed that they had broken a taboo. Mm-hmm. They had dietary laws. We have dietary laws in many cultures today. If they broke their dietary laws, if they mixed seal meat with caribou meat, the animals would be offended. Sickness would come to the family. Everything they did had a direct impact on their lives.
Elise Guttenberg with us in Conversations. This is a second odd question, and I almost feel like apologizing for it, but I can't help but ask. We talk about walking a mile in someone's shoes. You walked for how long in these people's shoes?
Several years it took to write this book.
Did you find yourself moving into what I think of with great respect as an indigenous attitude? Did you find yourself moving closer to the earth and closer to spirit? Or was this, with equal respect, the act of a craftsperson, a researcher and a writer?
Well, I think both things are true. While I'm writing, and while I'm sitting in my office in front of the computer, I think after a while it becomes easier and easier. I get used to the scenery that I'm imagining in my mind as a writer, and it does become easier to enter into that place. But I'd also love to go outside and feel the wind and say, ah, is this what it felt like?
Yeah.
Or listen to the sounds outside. I was able, in researching this, to take one trip up to Shishmaref and walk out on the ice. And that was a wonderful experience for me. I'm, you know, in here in Fairbanks, we're landlocked, and this is definitely a coastal story.
Mm-hmm.
The coast that I knew was, you know, perhaps Ketchumak Bay, or, you know, the places that the road takes us from Fairbanks. So this was a wonderful trip, and I did feel as if it was also a ritual returning to that area in sorts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
While I was in Shishmaref, I was lucky enough to be befriended by some of the older women who actually allowed me to help them butcher a seal on the ice.
Oh.
And I don't know if I conveyed to them or could hardly keep back the excitement that I felt, you know.
Because it's in your hands, not in your head.
It's right. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What a difference. What did you learn from this project? Your first book was a fantasy, a science fiction fantasy. You literally created the world. You were the captain of this first ship of Sunder, Eclipse, and Seed, absolutely. You shared joint captaincy with history and imagination with Summer Light. You worked through archaeological papers and through ethnographies and histories and other people's point of view and an existing culture that was constantly, I would dare say, somewhere sitting next to you, close to the computer. And you worked with your imagination. So this was a new book for you and a new style of writing, yes?
Yes,
that's,
and no.
Okay, well, yeah, that's what I'm interested in. Did something happen that was percolative from that process for you?
Yes and no. I think there are many similarities in writing the fantasy, which is, the fantasy that I write is an anthropological sort of fantasy. In my first book, what I set out to explore was a mythology. That was why I wrote it. Those were the questions that I set up. I wanted to invent a mythology. But before I started writing Sunder Eclipse and Seed, I spent 3 months producing, from my own imagination, background material, creating that world that I would write from. I put together a notebook in alphabetical order, and I sat down and did huge flowcharts of a new mythology that I invented, and that's the title represents the three goddesses, Sunder, Eclipse, and Seed, mm-hmm. in that book. When I started to write Summer Light, most of the skills were the same. I spent 3 months of research. It's almost, I think of it as immersing yourself the way people do when you're studying a foreign language.
Sure.
You read and you read and you read until the ambience becomes second nature, and becomes part of your language. And I did that before I began writing. So on both hands, both books, fantasy and prehistory, one is grounded in a concrete reality, you know, one is grounded in an imagined reality, but both books, because they're presenting cultures that are so different, they walk a straight line in reality. They present themselves as realistic books.
Yeah.
We are inside a culture, telling a story from that culture's worldview. We're not outsiders. My narrators don't stand outside looking in, judging from, you know, our 20th century view. With Sunder, Eclipse, and Seed, when I wanted to write a mythology, a book that explored mythology, I knew that if I took that story that I wanted to write and set it in our world today, then I would have to write a book where everybody challenged and questioned the beliefs. Oh, you can't have gods and goddesses walking around. Oh, you can't have dreams. That book was concerned a lot with dreams.
Right.
That are true. We don't believe you. Prove it. Well, I didn't want to write a book that proved it. I had to be inside that culture. I think the writing skills were the same.
Mm-hmm.
Very much the same.
That's very interesting, because I would have thought differently, but I didn't comprehend this notion of research for fantasy at all.
Yeah. Consistency is the key word in writing a fantasy. You have complete freedom, people think, but you only have complete freedom on day one. On day two, you must constantly refer back to what you did on day one.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't throw out in the middle of a book something that is not possible, that you have not created.
Did you know when you began as a writer that you would write such huge books? I mean, that sounds like a silly question, but Sunder, Eclipse, and Seed is almost 400 pages. Summer Light is almost 500. My sense is that they're dictated by the questions they deal with. The size is it's big book, big questions.
Mm-hmm.
But did you know these are really big questions? And
I think it's because the big questions interest me that I write the kinds of books that I've been writing.
Mm-hmm.
I think what we think of the stories that are literary stories today, they're relationship stories. They're stories about family and love. Usually, I'm generalizing here, of course. They don't always deal with belief in gods and the need to explore community, culture, survival in the same way. Perhaps because it's of my anthropology background, perhaps because that's what I always like to read. Those are the questions that interest me.
Mm-hmm.
And those questions need to, they take a tremendous amount of time. I was surprised that these books came out as long as they did. With Summer Light, I had actually hoped to write a shorter book. And I think that it's because I alternated chapters between Alanek and Elik,
yes.
My two main characters, that it kept growing longer and longer. I had two whole stories that I had to tell. I think the structure of it pushed it to be longer. People are telling me that it doesn't take long to read. I'm surprised and a little, very pleased, more than a little, but it comes as a relief.
You talk about what you wanted to explore as a writer. Are these topics the what you think also attracts such strong readerships to prehistories and to fantasy, science fiction fantasy?
the exploration of world, of culture, of possibility, mm-hmm. of...
Yeah, perhaps. I think that it takes a certain imagination, kind of imagination, to enter into these books. The editors in New York tell me that prehistories are very popular right now. And from the reactions that I've been getting from friends, it's interesting to me to see that people can enter much more easily into the world of this prehistory mm-hmm. than into the world of the fantasy in Sundry, Clips, and Seed.
And what do you think that is? Is it that we want to go find out where it started? And so we go back to... We find ourselves walking easily through the door to the past?
I think it's easier because there are so many known strains that we can pick up on. We've heard of shamans. We understand that we're exploring a specific known culture. In the fantasy, the general reader, I think, has a harder time saying, what is this we're talking about? Wait, I don't follow this new kind of mythology. What does this term that I've invented, Jarek dreams it was in the book,
right.
What does this mean? And it's harder.
And is there a problem for some suspending disbelief?
That's what I suspect. And when I tell people to read, I say, don't worry about the names. I'm always telling people, don't worry about the names. By a couple of chapters, by 50 pages, it's gotten down to only a few main characters.
Uh-huh.
Go with the story.
Right. Interesting. Interesting. Tell me, I want to change the topic here and ask you about genre wars a little bit. But first, I'm doing you a disservice. Let me, for people who have just joined us or for people who are curious as we've been going along about our guest today, Elise Guttenberg has been in Fairbanks since 1972. She and her husband and two children make their home in Esther. Her educational background is from the University of Alaska, Fairbanks, a bachelor's in anthropology, and then a master's in English. She's served the arts community actively over the years she's been in Fairbanks, largely through the Alaska State Council on the Arts. She has served their literature panel on and off, mostly on, since 1985, right? More than 10 years. Currently, she serves as well the Fairbanks North Star Borough Library Commission. Elise Guttenberg has three books out to her credit. The first is an edited book, co-edited with Elise Guttenberg and Jean Anderson, also a Fairbanks writer, a co-founder of Permafrost, the UAF English Department's literary anthology, a co-founder with Elise. Jean is the winner of the Penn Syndicated Fiction Award and a short story writer from Fairbanks. So the first was Inroads. That book collected the works of the 27 Alaskan artists who had up till 1988 won Alaska State Council on the Arts fellowships. First collection of that kind. The first book of Elise's writings, as we've mentioned, is called Sunder, Eclipse, and Seed. It's not currently in print to, as we speak, as Elise and I record this.
But the editors should be bringing it back out.
But it's coming, yes. It's returning, along with the second book, called The Leaves of Sion. So look for a New American Library / Penguin book called Sunder, Eclipse, and Seed returning to the shelves, and with it, soon, The Leaves of Sion, the second of the trilogy that Sunder, Eclipse, and Seed began. And then the book we've been spending much of our time today talking about is Summer Light. That's a HarperCollins book. It came out in paper in 1995. Elise Guttenberg, our guest today on this edition of Conversations. I want to ask you about genre wars because I think you have an interesting attitude on how writers get lost in the pigeonholes of somebody else's opinion about genre. You have been called a fantasy writer. Tell me how you'd like to be thought of and what that means to you.
Well, I see myself as a fiction writer. And I see fantasy, science fiction, mysteries, genre writing as definitely existing in what people sometimes call the little ghettos, you know, of different areas. I don't see it that way. I have a little metaphor, what have you, of fiction as being a great house, a mansion, and every room is a different genre, and you can have a mystery over here, you can have a fantasy, you can have magical realism, you can have a prehistory, you can have your literary novel, you can your short stories. But the door's all open on corridors that interjoin, and there are secret passages, and there's the nice. The other rooms of voice and tone and the techniques that you bring to fiction, and they're perhaps the furniture in the house, and that all moves around. And I think when a writer starts out with the idea of a story, the writer has to decide where you're going to set that story. As I said earlier, a book like Summer Light Sundry Clips and Seed, needed to be in a room that was similar to fantasy, because I didn't want to have to deal with the questions of proving things inside yes. that book. The questions that I wanted to deal with were mythological and large questions. So I don't like being pegged as a fantasy writer. I feel as if I have many different kinds of stories inside of me. When I get to writing another story, another book, I'll decide where I want to go and live with that book. It could be a contemporary story. It could be another prehistory. Mm-hmm. None of that is set ahead of time.
Do you think this is good advice for the reader as well? As you're talking, I'm thinking that we too can avail ourselves of different rooms depending on what our questions are, what our interests are at that moment.
Yeah, and our interests change. And yes, I read in many different kinds of fields. As a writer, I'll read a mystery to see how did they do that scene? How did they get that tension in there? And how did they, drop little red herrings along the way? And I want to borrow some of those techniques. Mm-hmm. The best writing, and I think we should all look for the best writing, uses some of everything, magical realism will bring in a shower of flowers falling. Maybe it won't deal with trying to prove or explain why the flowers will fall when someone's tears are crying. But I will borrow all those techniques, and I think most readers can enter into many of those different rooms. Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think we'd all be better for it. I like to read about a book set on the East Coast, a book set in another country, a book set in the past.
Mm-hmm. Just a vagrant thought. Is an Alaskan writer at a disadvantage these days? You seem to be doing well with publishers and having your words go to a national market.
I think some people writing in Alaska will worry that they are misunderstood by outside publishers. But I don't really think that that's a problem. I think that while we're at a geographical disadvantage, it does help once in a while to go out to where the publishing world is, and usually that means New York. But it's not necessary. Writers live all over the country. I think we're very lucky right now. People all over the country happen to be interested in Alaska. They're very interested. That's how I got to write Summer Light, was those editors saying, when are you going to do your Alaskan book? Also, I'd been writing for a long time before I published, and I think networking is really a key to publishing. Mm-hmm. Talk with other writers, find out what they're doing, shake hands with the visiting writers who come up here. The Midnight Sun Writers Series, while it was on, and brought up editors and brought up writers who usually were very generous with names and with connections. And that's how I published my first book. There was visiting writers here. Nancy Willard gave me the name of one of the editors she works with, a woman named Barbara Lucas, who eventually gave me the name of my agent, who eventually sold my book. Keep talking to people, network. You don't have to go to the publishing centers until you have a finished book. Mm-hmm. In fiction especially, this is true. If you want to go to New York, we're talking about novels here. I'm not talking about short stories. That's quite a different route. And it's different, again, if you write nonfiction. But with your first novel, you have to have a finished book first. And it's that finished book that gets you in the door, and uh-huh. That's what matters most.
So do the writing first, but mm-hmm. don't forget to network. And I hear you saying see yourself at the center, because you can be wherever you want to be, and the center is accessible, whether from Alaska or New York.
And I'll tell you something that I think Alaskans have as an advantage. I think we have a faith in our ability to do things, our independence, that you perhaps don't feel as much if you live in a huge population center where you see yourself as one person among many and you wonder, oh, I'll never get in the door. I'll never have a manuscript that shines above all the others. Here I think we think pretty highly of ourselves. We have a can-do attitude. We feel as if we can make a difference. And I think that attitude carries us very far in our endeavors.
Mm-hmm. Keep that chutzpah.
Yeah.
We have picked out in the book more passages than we have read. Is there something that you'd like to read before we go away? And then I want to ask you where this book is carrying you into the next book. Because you're working on Summerlight sequel as we speak, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I'm in the middle of a first draft, and it'll take another year for sure.
It's kind of nice to know where your year is coming.
This is a section that you had said that you liked earlier.
It's Alanak back with us. Yes, all right. Okay.
And he's just had another one of his confrontations with the people of Elik's uncle's village where he's been staying. And he's left the house in anger, and he's walking out on the ice. I am not the enemy, Alanak told himself as he walked over the rough ice nearest the shore, out onto the smoother, wind-blown surface of the open fields. He slowed only once, looking to the wind to study the weather. The air was sharply cold and still. Overhead, no stretching clouds showed where a wind might rise and move the ice. No haze, no snow. There was a water sky away in the distance, hovering, with a line of dark to show a lead reflecting open water. Then another lighter line, where there would be ice again, and the moving edge of the ice pack somewhere beyond. At home, in his seal people's place, it would have been different. There would have been a north and a south side to the jutting land, and the wind, it would have moved in ways he understood. More dangerous it blew from the north, shifting the ice, more trustworthy from the south. Closer to shore, he would have known how to tell whether the ice was safely grounded. Not like here, where people sometimes woke to find huge fields had broken off and floated free. He kept on walking. I am not the enemy, and I have brought no evil into the long coast village. He reached the first ridge of towering pressure ice, the landfast piles that heaved upward in different patterns every year, built by storms, by currents, by the wind and sky itself. Even in this place, where the pack moved differently once winter settled, a man could generally trust this near-shore ice. He climbed the boulders on knees and hands, feet and elbows, scrambling till he was over. Only when the ridge was behind him, blocking sight of the shore, did he slow and try to think. He should have allowed his thoughts to guide him instead of his anger. Anger made him careless, starting out on the ice like a child with daylight already fading, erasing the shadows a man needed to see by. He'd taken less gear than he should have, though with luck, what he had would suffice. And he'd been walking quickly, not even willing to use his ice tester, the long-handled unak that was fitted with his toggling harpoon head on one end, an antler ice testing pick on the other. Bearhand had called him foolish. And the girl, Elik, she had heard. How could she not have heard? In the Kozki last night, just after he and Grail returned, before their news brought arguing, her brother, Aluparuk, had told how he'd come to the long coast for hunting. The wife didn't need to invent reasons to travel with him. But Elik, why had she come? Could they have hoped that food would be more plentiful here than in their own Bent Point village? He couldn't know, and it might not matter. For now he had other worries. Grail, the forest man who'd run away. What if, even after burning the stranger's bones, the murdered spirit found its way to the long coast village? What if it brought sickness? And what if the other man came back, hungry for revenge? What if, unwitting though it would have been, Bearhand was right, and he'd committed a terrible wrong? Perhaps he would stay out, let the ice decide his fate. It would be a test. No seal would come if it sensed evil. Either he would die, or a seal would come. He would only return when his hands had something to carry, a way to show the girl he was neither a boy nor a fool. He would go home with food, and the people would welcome him, and he would find a way to speak to her.
Before I ask you about the sequel, and truly we have 3 minutes left, I think, unfortunately, but how did you physically get the story and the research together? When you're writing this, I can see how Alanak's emotions push him forward and the history of his interactions push him forward, but then suddenly we have the wind and the lay of the land and the comparisons with other places and tools he's using or not using. And did this flow, or was this a stop and start and stop and start? And
you're asking about my techniques as a writer, and I remember writing this. This was... It's difficult to do this. This particular passage took many takes, mm-hmm. many edited versions. When I write my first draft, there's almost as many notes as action and thoughts. I'll have notes to myself like, what does the wind feel like? Or I'll have notes that say, go look up the book that I was reading that talks about the ice, and I'll write down the reference that I want to look. And in the second draft, maybe I'll enter those notes in. And then as I keep going over it, I will read passages out loud. I read a tremendous amount of this out loud over and over again. And I actually probably write much more than what on one of those drafts than what's here in the end. After I get all these notes, and both to myself and from the material, I cut it back. I say, I don't need it as a long explanation. I need, okay, story, motivation, personality, wind,
so you
weather.
Bring us back to the first mm-hmm. point, which is where's our story coming
right.
from?
Always the story. Mm-hmm. And I know that I worry constantly about keeping it clean that way. You know, how do you make... How do you find that middle of the road between balancing detail and story? And,
this is a great life for you, isn't it? I mean, it just kind of fits.
Yeah. When it goes, it's a great feeling. Yeah. You know, when it's working, time disappears.
Our time has disappeared. This is too bad. The sequel picks up where Ilik has become a shaman and Alanak is and she are partnered?
It's about a year later, uh-huh. and they've been living together, and Alanek decides it's time to go back and get revenge for his father's death.
Which began the first book.
Yes.
Yeah. Summer Light is the name of the book. Read it now and then wait a year for the sequel. Sequels are great fun for readers because, you know, you get to go right back in the story again. Mm-hmm. I hope it's being for you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Elise Guttenberg, thanks very much. Most interesting hour.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Look for her books. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. I hope you join me again next week.